Hi, I'm Malcolm Nichols.
And I'm Richard Ayling.
And this is Man Reimagined, a podcast where we, as men, attempt to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century.
How can we respond to the big questions that we're facing, both within ourselves and within society, and make sense of this ever-changing world?
We don't have all the answers, but we do want to create a conversation. So join us moving forward as a man reimagined.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Man Reimagined podcast with my good self, Richard Ayling, and my other good friend, Malcolm Nichols, over there in New Zealand, but not for long. Mal, say hello and tell us why you're excited today.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, it's great to be here, and I'm super excited because tomorrow I'm jumping on a plane and heading back to my heartland back in Bali. So forgive me if I'm a little bit jumpy in this podcast today because I'm excited as all get out.
I'm excited as you are for another reason, and that is we have a special guest on today to talk about something that we haven't really addressed in any sense since we began the podcast. And yet when we both saw it, we're like, damn it, that's a great topic that we really need to start to address. And that is the kind of potentially sticky or uncomfortable topic of porn addiction. And to do that, we've got a cool guy that was reached out to us that I've read up on his stuff. I'm really, really interested to hear him speak. And he's hanging on the line right now. So to speak about him in the third person just gets weird after a while. So Jeremy, he's just sat there patiently waiting. Jeremy Lipkowitz. Hello, sir. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a joy to be here and happy to talk to you guys about porn addiction.
Let's, before we sort of dive right into that, I mean, perhaps you can just tell us a bit about, you know, yourself, what you actually do, because it's not limited to just this one thing, right? You're a human with several disciplines and talents. So perhaps introduce yourself, tell us whereabouts in the world you are and what you're up to.
Yeah, so I'm based in Amsterdam and I'm a executive coach, leadership coach. I teach emotional intelligence and mindfulness in companies and corporations. And I also do a lot of coaching with men who are struggling with any sort of compulsive digital addictions. Sometimes it's pornography, sometimes video games, social media can also be quite addictive, but really helping people break free of some of these compulsive behaviors. My background is a little bit more in the sciences. So I studied genetics and genomics, was working on a PhD at Duke, and then realized I was just more passionate about mental health and well-being. So I left the sciences, left academia, and decided to devote my life to really teaching people about mental health. Also spent a little bit of time in Asia, spent some time training as a Buddhist monk in Myanmar. So big background in meditation and mindfulness as well.
Sorry, that was a pause there. I was like, when I heard that the piece about the Buddhist monk, I all of a sudden thought, wow, there's a rabbit hole we could go down, but we won't go down that tonight. But that's a fascinating history that you're bringing to the table here, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, and it's a rabbit hole we could go down because it's very much related to my story of porn addiction and, you know, the link between Buddhist philosophy and meditation and mindfulness in terms of breaking free from addiction, it's very intertwined together. So we might bring a little bit into the conversation.
Great. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I'm keen to understand why you're so keen and open to talking about porn addiction, because it's something that I sense a lot of men struggle with. I think that porn's out there, but it's not something we talk about. And, you know, everyone has a look, you know, but there's mm-hmm. how often are we looking and what damage is that actually doing? So why make, like, I'm guessing, I know that there's a great backstory here. So talk to us about you and porn.
Yeah. Well, it really does come from my own history with it, my own struggles with it for many years as, you know, as a young adolescent, as a teenager, as a college student. And just knowing how painful it is to go through that alone and then having come out of that and realizing how much better it is on the opposite side of it when you're not stuck in that addiction. It does feel like kind of my mission in life these days to show people. The one thing I really try to get across is to let people know that they're not alone. You know, that you're not broken, you're not a pervert, you're not a horrible person for watching porn and getting into stuff. And that there's a way to cultivate a healthier relationship to your sexuality, to other people, to yourself. So I really see it as such an important topic, especially because it is so shameful, it is so sensitive that we don't talk about it a lot, even though it's this huge, you know, it's like the iceberg metaphor. We see a little bit of the tip of it, but it's such a big issue and getting worse, really. So, yeah.
So I'm curious just to actually define what porn addiction actually is. You know, maybe just start there and give us a handle on what you think and describe what somebody who is addicted to porn, what that might be.
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say it's a spectrum, and there is a huge diversity of where somebody might fall on that spectrum. An addiction can be fairly loosely defined as anything that you kind of continually do despite negative consequences. So repeated use despite it having some negative consequence or effect on your life. And so we can see that that's could be true for types of eating issues, types of relationships with gaming or gambling. Anything can fall into that addictive spectrum. And we know now that it's not just about drugs and alcohol and substances. Behavioral addictions are very much on the same neural circuitry as well. It's the dopamine reward pathway that can get hijacked. When it comes to a porn addiction, it's really a introspective self-assessment to see how is this impacting my life? Is this having negative consequences on my life? For some people, it's very obvious, you know, spending 7 or 8 hours a day watching porn to the point where, you know, they're bleeding because they're masturbating too much. For other people, it might be using it, you know, just every day, maybe once a night. And there are questions there around what is a healthy use of pornography, what is unhealthy, and it's a personal decision. But just that question of asking, how is this affecting my life and what are the consequences of this behavior, starts to give you a little bit of some insight into whether or not it's an addiction for you. And another great way to tell, just to say, is if it's something that you, well, there's a bunch of ways to tell. One is if it's something that you want to do less of, but you can't help yourself, that's another good sign. So if it's a compulsive relationship to it, you can't control yourself, that's one way. Another way is that if it's no longer pleasurable, like you crave it and you do it because you need to do it, but you're not actually enjoying it in the midst of it, you're just kind of doing it because you have to, that's another sign that it's gotten into that addictive stage. The problem with that is that with porn, there's so much novelty on the internet that it's easy to be stimulated constantly because you can just get more and more extreme, more novelty. So, yeah.
Well, I had to, you know, back up and have take a deep breath when you said 7 or 8 hours of porn. I had to take a moment there, far out. What do you think in terms of percentages and men and porn? And I mean, how many men? I mean, is it a big issue, do you think, amongst men? And also maybe talk about ages too, like young versus old and things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, in terms of the percentages of how many people watch porn, it's super high, right? Especially among men. We are sexual beings, you know, and our sexuality is such an important and beautiful part of who we are. And to have, you know, unlimited free access to things that stimulate that part of who you are as a human, of course, people are going to be looking at it and watching it. So I'm not sure of the exact percentages. The question of, you know, for how many people is it an issue? That I also don't know, but anecdotally, it's so prevalent and it's so much more than we realize, and it's getting worse. I mean, if you talk to young kids, you know, I can talk also about my own history with it, how I got into it and what it looked like for me when I was struggling with it. But just imagine, you know, I'm 36 now, And I can only imagine when I was 8 years old, if I had access to what's online today, and if I had a smartphone in my pocket when I was 8 years old, I would just be, you know, diving into the depths of what is there. Like for us, it was, you find a Playboy magazine, you get a lingerie catalog in the mail. Like, you know, it starts kind of soft a little bit. But what young kids have access to these days, unlimited in their pockets at all times, it's, you know, of course it's going to be a more difficult kind of addiction for them.
Yeah, you mentioned this idea of extreme, and you mentioned novelty. Mm-hmm. And I there's a link between kind of wanting more novelty and then, of course, things getting, well, I've seen this, and it leads us towards more, as men, perhaps women as well, to wanting more kind of extreme forms of porn, right? Like,
yeah,
that seems like deeply unhealthy, because then for me, it becomes divorced from the reality of what sex and intimacy actually is. There was a porn star called Stoya who said that, it's a great metaphor. She talked about, the sex that happens in porn, it's kind of like, you know, there's like driving a car, and then there's driving those gigantic sort of like 4x4s, like around a huge stadium. And it's like this, you know, this completely different things. And yet we're getting more and more exposed to this. Like, I'm curious about your journey and your experience. Mm-hmm. Like just you mentioned it, extremes, like what does extreme look like in terms of the kind of porn, and also how many hours? Cause I also was like, you know, 7 or 8, that's insane, you know? And yet that you're saying that that's also, is someone that can watch it for half an hour also addicted, you know, if they're doing it regularly?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is where it's such a nuanced discussion, because there's so much diversity in how people use it, the intentions behind, you know, why people are using it. Also the, how extreme or not people get into. There's a couple of things that can go on. One is that as you get habituated to the porn that you're watching and you need more extreme things to get you off, it's a slow but steady increase. And this is one of the real messed up things, is you don't notice it. It's just over time, it's, you know, maybe every night it's getting a little bit more interesting, or a little more, oh, okay, well, oh, that's titillating, that's exciting, or that's taboo, which can turn you on a little bit more. So that's one thing, is getting into extreme forms of pornography. And, you know, we can talk about that. There's all sorts of, most guys know kind of what is available out there. They might not have watched it, but they know how disgusting it gets on porn. Not necessarily a lot of women know how gross it gets on there, but, you know, there's rape porn, incest porn, bestiality, child pornography. I mean, there's really disgusting, horrible things online. And, you know, there have been studies that looked at the most popular porn, and 95% of it is aggressive and violent towards women and all this kind of stuff. So there's a lot we could go into on that. The thing that I noticed for myself in my own journey, it wasn't that I was necessarily getting into stuff that was outside of my ethical guidelines. But one of the things I did notice is that I was becoming so much more perfectionistic in what I saw as someone who I would want to sleep with. You know, somebody, because every night I was looking at porn for 3 or 4 hours, and I was always looking at hot young porn stars, my idea of what a woman needed to look like was at this high, high level, that when I was sleeping with somebody who was a normal, beautiful person, who might have had some belly fat, or might have had some cellulite, or might have had some body hair, you know, it wasn't good enough. And so I was kind of, you know, constantly building up these expectations that weren't real. So unreal expectations is one of the things that causes, one of the consequences of porn addiction. But there's so many other consequences. And this is one of the problems of porn addiction, is that it can be very hard to see the consequences, because they're very subtle and they're not necessarily direct links. So if you have a drug addiction, like heroin addiction, you can usually see the consequences. They're very easy to see the link between drug use and the consequence. With porn addiction, because there's such subtle consequences, you often don't even realize them because they've just slowly built up over your life. And also you don't even realize the connection because you might be dealing with dissatisfaction in your romantic relationships. And you're like, why am I never satisfied with my partners? And you don't realize it's because you've been watching 3 or 4 hours of porn and you're training your brain to look for perfection. That's the other problem with high-speed internet pornography. You know, these tube sites where you scroll and there's thousands and thousands of videos, is you're training your brain to look for novelty and look for perfection. You know, you might be scrolling through these videos, and even when you find a video, you're scrolling through the video to find the perfect spot or the perfect position. And you're training yourself to, it's just a total mind fuck in the way that it distorts what healthy intimacy is, what real sexuality is, because the majority of porn is just created for men and it has nothing to do with what women actually want. But there's, I just opened up so many different rabbit holes that we could go down, and I'll let you guys see where you want to go.
Yeah, that was, I actually found myself in the state there of being a pure listener to everything that you said, and probably the thing that happened then was a bit of a personal reflection around my own experience of watching porn and the impact of that I was just reflecting on the impact of that potentially on my intimacy. You know, I wouldn't consider myself a big porn watcher, but I know I've watched it. But you know, you talked about that sense of perfection and the impact that it has on my sense of who I am when it comes to being in an intimate relationship with somebody, like performance and, you know, these kinds of words, right? And I can imagine that it's, I mean, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are around the way it's changed habits in terms of the way men have sex with women now as a consequence of porn. Do you think how much of an impact do you think it's had on the actual act of sex and intimacy?
Yeah, I mean, huge. So there's a couple of things. One is just what it does to our brain on a neurological level. I remember reading this study once that showed that when we are watching porn, they've done these fMRI studies, and they found out that the networks that are activated when you're looking at porn are the same networks that are activated when you're looking at an object like a pencil or a cup. They're not the networks that are activated when you're looking at a human being. And so what that shows us is when we're engaged in pornography, we're viewing it, we're viewing women and these people we're seeing on a screen as objects. And that's how we're strengthening those neural pathways. In terms of how it's affected how men are having sex with women, there's also all these horror stories of, I was reading these studies that the number of young women going to the doctors because of health issues because of anal sex, because they're having anal sex at younger and younger ages and getting more kind of damage, you know, in those areas because, you know, it's painful, they don't do it well, all these different things, is growing year by year. And just the way that it affects our view of what healthy sex looks like is just so, it's hard to, you know, to overstate it, really.
Yeah, I've read up on this a little bit. And, you know, there was an argument that the porn industry has normalized anal sex as being something, you know, that everyone does because you see it so often. Yeah. And so, yeah, more, and especially if with this not enough awareness and you know, younger people are not going to have that necessarily, then there's physical damage. But then this sort of disgusting violence that is out there also, and just kind of you know, there's this slapping of different parts of the women's, you know, slapping an ass or even a breast or the face, or just, you know, the more that that's out there, that becomes normalized. And there's also lots of women reporting that kind of thing, and also extreme other acts that they are just like, they're starting to think, well, okay, this is what sex is, so yeah, I better say yes.
Exactly.
And it's like so deeply messed up, and it also adds to a lot of fuel to the fire of like women going, what the fuck is going on with men, you know, which I have no defense to. It's like, wow, well, you know, this is a real problem. So yeah. As much as that's been normalized, like, I think we need to start normalizing this kind of conversation. You know, I mean, that's what this podcast is really about. Me and Mal wanted to normalize these kind of tricky conversations that men weren't having. And I think it's about men actually having them and doing something different. And so to bring you back in, like, where to from here? You know, what are the first steps? Because you mentioned Buddhism and becoming a monk, and that's not obviously realistic for everyone. I'd want to hear that story, and I want to hear the benefits of it. But maybe what are some first steps for men listening that are going, yeah, okay, it's not 8 hours a day, but, you know, this has crept into my life. What can we do differently?
Well, I'll kind of go back to my origin story of the moment that I realized I had this addiction. I'd been watching porn since an early age, maybe 8 or 9 years old. Started with comic books, went on to lingerie catalogs, dial-up internet where you download photos. And then into college, I was watching, 3 to 4 hours of porn a night. And it was this secret thing. You know, sometimes it would be 2 hours. But almost every night I would find myself locking my door, pulling open my laptop, and it would be 2 to 3 hours, up to 4 hours of looking for the perfect video to finish on. And you're just constantly searching, finding keywords and genres. And by the end, you're just drenched in your own sweat. You feel like a piece of shit. And then you close your eyes and fall asleep. And I remember what I would have these nights of, I would close my eyes and it would just be nonstop images of porn, just see, the porn I was watching, but it was just, just closing my eyes and I couldn't even stop seeing images of porn. But it came to a head when I had this moment where I was walking down the street in Davis, California. So I was a student at UC Davis and my life was quite nice on the outside. I had a lot of friends. I had, good romances. I was captain of a sports team, getting straight A's in all my classes. So my life was quite amazing on the outside. And I was walking down the street and I saw these two girls walking in front of me and they were wearing these kind of yoga, yoga tights. And I remember just staring at the butts of the girls in front of me. And I was just so filled with lust. I had complete tunnel vision. I couldn't see anything, couldn't think about anything. All I could think about was how much I wanted to have sex with them. And it was in this moment that it felt like a black hole was opening up inside of me with this big emptiness where I felt like, unless I can have that, and it was just this primal, wanting to grab and squeeze and fuck. And I thought, unless I can have that, I won't be happy. And it was this moment of realizing that lust itself was a really painful experience. That when you want what you don't have in that moment, you're not happy because you're not appreciating the blue skies, the friends you have, the fact that you're alive. You're in that moment, you're in a state of lack. You're not in a state of gratitude or abundance or contentment. And so what I had in that moment was kind of an existential crisis where I thought, if I'm not happy now when everything is going well, I'll never be happy because everything I put my mind to, I could achieve. And I did achieve, straight A's, captain of sports team, all that stuff. And I realized that if I don't make a change, I'm never going to be happy. And the other thing that happened is I realized if I don't make a change and I keep living this life of watching porn and chasing after girls and all this stuff, I'm going to end up as this 70-year-old perverted man who's trying to pick up college girls at bars. And I saw that future for myself, and I saw the reality of that's where I was headed if I didn't change something. And that was a moment. And this is one of the things I teach in my program and in the work I do with guys is that envisioning the future that you're headed on, if you don't make a change, is really important. It's what I call the default future. If you don't make a change, where are you headed? And I saw that my future was headed towards depression, dissatisfaction, emptiness. I might be having sex, but I would feel empty, And I would be just one of these perverted guys. I wouldn't be in the kind of life that I wanted, which is deep, fulfilling relationships, contentment, general life fulfillment, living a good, purposeful life. So that moment was really pivotal for me. And that got me started on my journey of looking into happiness and positive psychology. Ended up finding this one book on meditation, and that book changed my life forever. It was this book called Happiness by Matthieu Ricard. And what I really loved about it is that Matthieu Ricard is this Tibetan Buddhist monk, but he spent many of the years of his life, he's from France and was studying molecular biology and got his PhD in molecular biology. And he wrote this beautiful book that looked at what real happiness is. And it wasn't too religious. It wasn't woo-woo kind of nonsense. It was just looking at what does it mean to be happy? And that book, there were two key insights from that book. One is that happiness is a skill that you train. You know, it's like there are things that lead to happiness, things like compassion, contentment, gratitude, you know, patience. Those are the things that actually lead to the experience of feeling happy and fulfilled. And the other key insight that I got from that book, and this is related to the porn stuff, is he brought in some neuroscience and he talked about neuroplasticity. And I remember this one quote, he said, "Neurons that fire together, wire together." And it was this understanding that the more frequently you use certain neural pathways, the stronger those neural pathways become. And I realized that I had been hardwiring lust and craving and desire into my mind from a young age. And that I was actually creating the conditions for my own unhappiness by constantly indulging in that craving and strengthening those neural pathways rather than strengthening the neural pathways of contentment and compassion and patience and all those beautiful things. So that was a kind of a life-changing moment for me.
And that spurred you on to then become a monk? Or I mean, this is beautiful sharing, so I don't mean to diminish it, but like, was that the moment you were like, I need to become a monk? Or what? That's a life-changing shift, you know? So how long were you doing that for?
So did they give you? That insight changed the trajectory of my life. It felt like 180 degrees. Because before that, I was just going after, how can I have as much validation as possible, as much external success, as much pleasure? You know, I was just trying to maximize pleasure and validation and success. And that book made me realize that if what I really want is to live a life of deep inner fulfillment, my strategy is entirely fucked up. That I'm going about completely the wrong way. And that instead cultivating these mental qualities, cultivating the conditions of the mind that directly lead to happiness is what I need to do. So that got me started on meditation, mindfulness. I traveled to India, started doing these silent meditation retreats. Some of your listeners might know Vipassana. And in the West, Vipassana is known through a different name called insight meditation. Very similar to the Vipassana that people know about with Goenka, but it's a bit more westernized, a bit less religious, more focused on kindness and compassion as well. So I started doing a lot of retreats and these silent meditation retreats, you know, learning how to cultivate my mind, strengthen my mind, learning how to let go of constant craving and suffering of, you know, wanting what I don't have. That was a long journey for me. I started doing I went on a silent retreat once or twice a year. So around every 7 or 8 months, I would go on a silent meditation retreat. And I did that just, you know, as a part of my own practice and did that for about 10 years. It wasn't until 10 years later that I ordained as a monk, but that was as a very short time, just as an experience. I was doing a kind of a month-long silent retreat in Burma, and you had the opportunity to ordain while you were doing that. So I wouldn't say that monkhood was a huge part of my life, but this kind of style of meditation, insight meditation, learning how to cultivate the mind is a big part of it.
I'm always struck often, Rich, when we have people come on the podcast like you, Jeremy, and there's the element of transformation and the way there's always a spiritual awakening that seems to underpin a lot of our transformation. But I was thinking a little bit now in terms of, you know, people who are listening, for example, if somebody is listening and going, shit, you know, maybe I've got a bit of an issue with porn, or I'm curious, you know, like, fuck, I am unhappy with with the amount of porn I watch, and I feel mm-hmm. a bit dirty, etc. You know, what is the process? I mean, what do you say to somebody who might want to make that first step of addressing it?
Yeah. For me, that first step is the awareness part. So part of it is really just seeing clearly, how are you engaging with it? What is the effect it's having on you? And also part of that awareness is the envisioning process. So looking at how you're using it and how it's affecting you, and what would be the consequences of that if it continued that way or got worse over time. And then I also like to do the flip side of that envisioning, which is to think, okay, that's the default future, but what is it that you truly want in life? You know, what is it that you want to cultivate? And that's what I call the dream future. And to actually spend time thinking about that, a lot of people don't stop and think, what is the future they want? But when they do this, they realize that almost every single person who I've talked to, it's all the same. You know, they want deep, fulfilling relationships, a sense of presence, a sense of contentment, a sense of integrity with who they are and kind of alignment with their values, you know, a sense of flow and feeling good in their body, exercise. And in almost all of these visualizations, having, you know, a relationship with porn that's compulsive and addictive is never a part of that dream future and is holding them back from that dream future. So doing that work of connecting with your default future and your dream future is really important. The other part is really important, which is taking ownership of your life, realizing that you are creating your life and nobody's going to come save you. You know, you have to be the one to say, all right, I'm fed up with this. I know it's not leading me to the future I want. I know it's not supporting me in my dreams, my aspirations. I need to do the work to end this. And so that's also really important. And there's a bunch of other things, but I think those two are kind of good starting places.
They kind of remind me of like what could be part of like a 12-step program. Is there a 12-step program related to porn addiction specifically? Because you talked about understanding the current trajectory and then a potential one. So it's almost like it's bringing up a sense of potentially healthy shame, like ownership, radical responsibility. These are the themes that I'm hearing first and foremost. So is there a 12-step program, or is that kind of what you're doing? You're building something like that. And how big a role is spirituality in that, do you think? Because there are obviously going to be some men that will be like, I'm not going to be in a fucking monk. And, you know, like there's obviously, there are plenty of secular kind of movements or programs out there that are kind of not offering that. So what do you think?
Totally. I'm glad you brought this up, because it's a huge thing that I don't think you don't have to be spiritual at all to recover. Like, and it's one of the reasons why I personally don't connect with 12-step programs, is you have to, you know, kind of surrender to the higher power and all this stuff. And I've always been atheist. I've always been secular, scientist. Even Buddhism to me was very, I was allergic to it for a long time until I realized it's just a way to train the mind and be a better human. And so I don't think you need to get into spirituality at all unless you're really connected to it. But I do think that thinking about these bigger questions in life of how do you want to live? You know, what way do you want to show up in the world? And for me, that is my spirituality, you know, embodiment of my values, how I show up for others, the values I bring, like compassion and service. For me, that's spirituality. But you don't have to do any sort of, you know, going on silent meditation retreats or becoming a monk. It's really about, that was my process. And I kind of had to do that because I didn't have the support that is out there today, which is, you know, why I'm here, is giving people this kind of support. But what you really need is that sense of ownership. And then you also need to be smart about your habits. You know, there's a lot of habit science that we know now about how to successfully break free from compulsive behaviors. And it's not just about willpower. It's not just gritting your teeth and pushing through. There's a lot of smart ways to support yourself. Some of that is stuff called behavioral architecture, where you're creating supportive environments. some of it's accountability. There's also a lot about letting go of shame. And I'm happy that you brought up healthy shame, because I think there is healthy shame and there's unhealthy shame. And we really need to understand the difference. If people just say, don't, you know, you should never shame or anything like that, it's like, there's certain things you should be ashamed of. And that's a healthy tool to use to say, this behavior that I'm about to engage in is not healthy. It's not appropriate. And if I did it, I would be ashamed. And it's a good thing I'm not doing it. And also for past behaviors to say, wow, that was a bad behavior. Let me use that sense of shame to not do it again. But to not think you're a broken person, that's the toxic shame, is when you think you are broken or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Hearing you speak here, Jeremy, it's bring up. So in my history, I've wound up in AA and NA to deal with some drug and alcohol issues in the past. And and you know, hearing you talk about this future imagining, right? It's exactly the process that I went through, which was my personal awakening, which was this thing of one day I thought, fuck, how would I feel about the choices I'm making right now? If somebody said to me, you've only got 6 months to live, how would I feel about the choices I'm making in my life right now? And it was in that moment, and hearing you talk about healthy shame that you and Rich have just mentioned, that's exactly the experience. Like hearing you talk about this right now, I'm almost reliving it.
Are you still there, Mal? Or are you deep in thought? Okay, looks like we lost Mal, but we're still recording. Mal's talking to himself in profound ways, I'm sure. It's a shame because he was really, I was enjoying listening to that. What would you respond, I guess, to Mal based on where he was going? That there wasn't a specific question, but he was really recognizing and reliving a similar experience of healthy shame. I mean,
yeah,
I guess for me, that's my therapist would describe healthy shame as being something that's essential for us. Otherwise we just drive this cars down the street, mowing old grannies over. And
yeah. Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Goodness
like,
yeah. knows we all just want to do that. Yeah.
It's like, this isn't helpful. There's a societal kind of thing going on.
Yeah. And,
but there's a bigger reckoning, perhaps that's too strong a word, but that I feel men need to have around this stuff. I mean, we can sort of point to this industry, the porn industry is satiating our needs and growing with them, but it's like, well, that industry is horrible. It's really a problem, and we're hooked on it, but we have to take responsibility for that, right? Like that's there's a level of healthy shame I think that might be helpful for us to feel individually, but also then collectively by speaking to this stuff. And again, there's too few conversations around this. I don't want to be negative, but how can we get this out there and talk about this more beyond these kind of beyond podcasts? Like how do you invite men to do that? Are there groups? Like what would be your advice or what inspires you?
Yeah. One of the reasons that I really feel compelled to come on podcasts like this or to, you know, get featured in articles like the one you read and talk about my own history with it is because it's such a shameful, sensitive issue that nobody wants to talk about. In me sharing my story is kind of letting people know it's okay to talk about, because nobody wants to talk about their porn habit. You know, very rarely do people want to do it, unless sometimes it's kind of a toxic talking about it, like, you know, bro culture, where it almost makes light of the issue. And so I think this tapping into that sense of responsibility and taking ownership for your actions, you know, and this is something I'm sure you guys talk about as healthy masculinity, but really owning up and taking responsibility. One of the concepts I love from Buddhism, there are these sometimes they're talked about as wholesome mind states. And so in Buddhism, a lot it's talked about, okay, how do you cultivate wholesome mental qualities? And it's very interesting because almost every single wholesome mind state that you can cultivate is a pleasant feeling, you know, like compassion, it feels good. Patience feels good. All of these wholesome mind states are pleasant, but there's two exceptions. There's two mind states that are wholesome to cultivate, but unpleasant to experience. And these are moral shame and moral dread. And so moral shame is that sense of something I did in the past that was inappropriate, that wasn't helpful, and I feel ashamed of that. And then moral dread is when you're thinking about doing something and you realize that if you do it, people, you know, will kind of look down on you or think you're, you know, whatever. It's that sense of I shouldn't do this thing. And those two, they're very unpleasant to feel, but they're very important. They're actually onward leading. You know, they lead you toward a greater future. And I love it because it's just those two. You know, those two are like these rare exceptions of the only two unpleasant mind states to cultivate that are actually wholesome and good for you. It's kind of like the medicine you need to take. But yeah, and there's so many directions we could go on this topic. And I want to come back to Mal because I know he cut out, but he's back with us. You were sharing some beautiful stuff, Mal. So jump back in.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, mate. I have to apologize. We had a power cut here and all of a sudden everything just went off. So I've gone on to like a temporary connection, so I hope this is okay. We'll have to wait and see how it goes, but yes, so I was just sharing about my experience around that sense of the awakening that came from that healthy shame of realizing how disappointed I would be in myself, you know, projecting into the future the sense of real disappointment in myself. And it was such a powerful motivator. It's almost nowadays when I think about, you know, certainly when I talk and work with people, that if I'm coaching or anything like that, that ability to kind of ask the question, how would I feel about the choices I'm making right now in the future, you know, if I was to put myself into that future? So yeah, I just wanted to share that as an experience, really. But I mean, I'm really curious, and forgive me if I'm asking a question that you and Rich have just been talking about for the last few minutes. But you know, when you're, I mean, I'm really curious to know just what you to get into the nuts and bolts of maybe what you do with people men in this process of working through their addiction. And how do you walk people through, which is, I mean, fuck, it's, I can imagine it would be a really hard thing for somebody to put their hand up and go, I'm struggling with this. Like, how do you make that first step? And then, and how do you encourage men to make that first step? And then what is the process for you from that point?
Yeah, such a great question. It is so challenging to make that first step. And I can share my own example. You know, when I realized I had an addiction and, you know, started breaking free and actually, you know, went to India, did a lot of this stuff that helped me get some space and actually recover and break free from my porn addiction. But from that point until the time where I could actually even mention to somebody that I had even watched porn, let alone struggled with an addiction to it, was 6 years later. And that was the first time that I barely had the courage to open up to a very close friend and say, you know, I used to really struggle with porn addiction. And that was after having been completely sober from porn for 6 years. And what that shows me is it's such a sensitive thing and it's so hard to talk about for so many of us men that I know. And I think that's one of the reasons that I can help the people that I help is I know what it's like to be in those shoes. And I know how hard it is to put your hand up and say, I think I have a problem. I need some help with this. And the hard part is you can't force that step. You know, it has to come from their own courage, their own inner strength of saying, I'm ready to get support. I'm ready to be vulnerable. But I think podcasts like yours, the kind of the movement of men, you know, like this, talking about what does it mean to be a man, what is healthy masculinity, how can we show up in the world that leads to healing a lot of the the harm that we have as men have caused. These discussions are so helpful in showing people that it's okay to raise your hand and ask for help. Once that happens, then it's a much easier process. You know, once a person first admits to themselves, I need to get some support with this, I need to at least admit it to myself and then maybe to another person, that begins a much easier journey. After that, you know, in terms of the work I do with them, you know, that a lot of that first step is around the awareness piece. How is this affecting your life? Where do you want to go? What's important to you? What do you want to cultivate? And then it's also a huge part of the work I do is around helping people let go of their sexual shame. You know, there's so much sexual shame in a lot of men. They feel like if they are sexual, if they show their sexual interest in a woman or in whoever, for the sake of ease of conversation, we can just generally talk about heterosexual men, you know, going after a woman. The sexual shame of feeling embarrassed about their sexuality, feeling like they're a pervert, feeling like they're gross or, you know, creep if they show interest. And this relates to kind of the nice guy syndrome that I know you guys have talked about before. Letting go of sexual shame is so important. Just saying, oh, I have sexual desires, I have sexual urges, and that's okay. Not only is it okay, it's actually beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful aspects of being a human is intimacy and sexuality and that interaction. And so letting go of shame is a super important component, but then having accountability is the other, it's like the two wings of recovery. Having that accountability is also so important because it's so easy to slip up, fall off the wagon, and then to have that support and say, it's all right, you know, get back on it, keep going. Because what happens is when somebody tries to do this alone, they might try for a couple of days and then something happens, they get emotional, and their coping mechanism, we haven't even talked about this, but you know, addiction comes as a coping mechanism, comes as a way to handle emotional pain and escape emotional pain. Or physical pain. What happens is because it is a coping mechanism, people then act out and use it as a way to cope with whatever emotions coming up, which then gets them falling back in that cycle. And then they feel ashamed that they've, you know, slipped up and relapsed. And so that cycle starts. But having accountability, having a mentor, a coach, a group, something like that that supports you is really important. And as much as I wish it could just be a friend, you know, friends are very rarely good accountability partners. Most of us know this in terms of, you know, work. Like you say, okay, we're going to crush it this month and we're going to work hard and you're going to be my accountability buddy. But it just doesn't work because friends can't hold us accountable in the same way that a group can or a coach can or a mentor. So finding some way of having really strong accountability is important. But and if all you have is a friend is a great place to start, just opening up about the conversation.
And do you find, you know, I mean, for you, is it a one-on-one thing, or do you find that groups are more effective, or is it a very personal experience when it comes to somebody wanting to seek help?
It's a bit of both. A lot of the work I do is one-on-one. Groups can also be very healing in different ways. Some people need that confidentiality of just doing a one-on-one session. And then some people also really benefit from having the group energy, the group support, actually being seen by other men and realizing, hey, I can talk about the fact that I am struggling with this and I'm not being shunned or stoned or called a pervert. So group coaching is a really powerful way also. Having that group support and realizing, hey, we're in this together. So it's a bit of both.
What is your experience of working with men in Amsterdam in this realm? I mean, I'm not sure how long you've been there, but you know, being over in Europe, my sense is that Europeans and English in particular, but Europeans are a bit more kind of closed off about these kind of things. Whereas America is, you know, you talk about everything. It's different, right? So what's your experience of being over in Amsterdam right now? Because they've got an interesting relationship to sex in a very you know, they've got their red light district, and it's a different culture.
It's a totally different culture, and I would say, in some ways, Europeans can be more closed off, but in other ways, they can also be more open. You know, it's nudity is, you know, like I remember coming to Europe when I was a teenager, just on a vacation, and you would see a commercial on TV, and there would be breasts on TV, and you'd be like, "What is going on?" Because in the US, that would never fly. And so there's, in some ways, there's actually more acceptance of sexuality here. You know, particularly in Amsterdam, where, you know, there's the red light district, prostitution is legalized. And so in some ways, there's more openness and there's less of that sense of shame. But I would say that, you know, even in places like this, where that is more normalized, I think you guys were even saying this on one of your previous podcasts about the nice guy syndrome. It's kind of irrespective of culture. You're always going to find shame around sexuality. You know, I'm not religious, but I find it interesting that in the Bible and the story of Adam and Eve, it's like they covered their genitals. It's like one of the first things that happens in the Bible is they are ashamed of their sexuality and they cover themselves. And so for some, it's fascinating that for some reason, sexuality is one of the most shameful things we have. Like, you can admit that you have, you know, an alcohol addiction. You can admit that you were a former drug addict. But admitting that you are a sex addict or a porn addict, for some reason, has this heightened intensity of shame. And I don't know where it comes from, but we know it's true. I mean, it's just very hard to open up and admit that. It happens all over the world. A lot of the people I work with are in the US, in Asia, some in Europe as well. Especially now that we are moving towards a more globalized society with the internet and with smartphones, porn addiction is reaching everyone, really.
Sorry, mate. They had to take
both of us in deep thought.
Yeah, exactly. Took a little pause there. It was. I mean, just such that wisdom or that peace. I was just lost really in that reflection around the shame of our sexuality and the reaching out around that. And that really, you know, that just really spoke to me. And I mean, what is it? What do you think? Like, how do we begin to release some of that shame, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is letting it be okay for yourself. I mean, the meditation school that I come from, this school of insight meditation, a lot of it is focused on not just mindfulness, but self-compassion and kindness, loving kindness, metta meditation, learning how to be kind towards yourself and others, and learning how to be a friend to whatever arises. And so part of that is this internal work that you have to do of saying, I'm okay with who I am. Like, I'm noticing a strong urge, a sexual desire, and oh, that's okay. I don't need to hide this from myself. I don't need to resist this. And a lot of that is internal work before it becomes external. You know, before you can go out into the world and practice expressing your sexual interest with a partner, and approaching a woman and saying, hey, I think you're really attractive. You know, could I get your number? Could we talk? Which can be done very powerfully, you know, in a very simple and in a way with a lot of integrity and beauty. But before you can do that, you have to own it for yourself and be at peace with it in yourself. And it's a process. You know, you might work a little bit on yourself and feel like, oh, okay, I can do this. And you might go out and try it, and maybe you get rejected and you feel fine about it because you were very straightforward and you weren't, you know, weird about it. You just, hey, you know, I think you're really beautiful. Could I get your number? And then sometimes it doesn't go well and, you know, you get rejected and then you feel shit about it. And it's a process of healing. It's a continual process of self-work.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of what you say in Tara Brach's work as well. Like, she's one of my favorite meditation teachers. It's also comes from that Buddhist tradition, and she talks about these two wings, as you mentioned earlier, in another context, but of compassion and awareness. And I'm just it makes so much sense what you're saying. It's like before we can normalize conversations with each other, we have to overcome our own internal sense of, can I be okay with that part of me actually, and forgiveness, mm-hmm. and these critical words. So it comes down to the, if I hear you right, like the internal work first, right? That this, mm-hmm. it just seems, and yet there's also, I'm wondering if it's a conversation I might start to bring up in men's circles as well. You know, like when, as with any circle, you sort of, you throw a question out into the room and then most men are silent. And then you go, okay, Jeff, what do you think? Well, everyone's going to just give their thoughts on it. And everyone pipes up on something, mm-hmm. you know? And so they're mm-hmm. just kind of raising that awareness within a group first, just to kind of know that, hey, look, there's a few people who've got this going on, to then be able to, or to want to feel the need to dive into yourself with this. It just feels kind of useful as well, right? The more we talk about it like this.
Yeah. And a related point that I'd love to bring up is also around leadership in men. And a beautiful way that you can be of service is when you do have that courage to be the first one to speak and be vulnerable, and to be a signal for other men of like, you know what, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to risk myself and be vulnerable and say, I'll be the first to say, hey guys, I'm struggling with porn addiction, or whatever, you know, hey guys, I'm struggling with loneliness, you know, whatever it is, to actually see that as an act of service and as a beautiful aspect of healthy masculinity. And I love that you guys talk about masculinity is not about, you know, are you a man or a woman? It's, these are qualities. And one of the qualities of masculinity, which can show up in men or women, is this sense of leadership, this sense of kind of protection and taking care and being of service. And of course, you know, I don't want to get in too much trouble. There's also qualities of femininity that are also about nurturing and loving and being of service in different ways. But it's a beautiful thing to do, to be courageous and show others that it's okay to talk about these things.
Thanks, Ben. I mean, that is such a beautiful piece that you've just shared right then. And, you know, I hear it time and again, but I don't think I could ever hear it enough about the gift of being willing to share, to being courageous, being, you know, creating an opportunity so that other people might be able to feel safe or to speak as well. You know, everything that you just said then is, you know, it's a thing that I know I need to hear constantly, time and again. So thank you so much for that. I mean, I'm in some ways that this conversation is really open. You know, it's not a topic that I've spent much time talking about or even kind of reflecting on personally. So it's been a real eye-opener for me. I really want to encourage anybody who's listening to, because it does feel to me like this is something that needs to be much more talked about and opened up about as a societal conversation. But if somebody wanted to reach out to you, if somebody wanted to make the step right now, I mean, what would you say? How do they reach out to you? What would you suggest to them that they do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always open for, if somebody's interested in working together on this, to just reach out through my website. There's a form you can submit. You don't even have to say anything about porn addiction. You can just kind of say, I'm interested in a discovery call, a chat, and you sign up. And if you're willing, you know, if you're willing to kind of say that that's what you want to talk about, you can put it in the form. But some people prefer to not say it. And then when they get on the call, they say, you know, this is what I'm struggling with. And then to reach out on social media, I'm also on, there's a lot of places people can connect with me. And there's also tons of, you know, I think one of you asked also, is there like a 12-step group around porn addiction? There are definitely 12-step groups around sex addiction. So there's Sex Addicts Anonymous, and there's another one that's kind of related to that. But there are groups, you know, all over the place that you can get connected to. But yeah, definitely to reach out to me. And the other thing I would say is that we've kind of been talking about this in the framework of porn addiction, but as you can probably guess, you know, it goes so much beyond that when we start looking at social media addiction and the way we engage with the dopamine networks of getting likes, you know, getting followers, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then dating apps, you know, swiping constantly, like looking for the unicorn, looking for the perfect person, never being satisfied. And so there's so many ways that these addictive behaviors, the way that we kind of get these dopamine dumps, can feed into our lives and affect us. And it's, you know, it's everywhere. When you really start to understand the way your dopamine works, the way addiction works, the way coping mechanisms, procrastination. You know, it's interesting. A lot of the guys who come to work with me, one of the biggest pain points is just that they're wasting so much of their life. It's not even so much of an ethical thing. They just, you know, 3-4 hours a day on Instagram, you know, looking at bikini models, and they realize like, this is not how I want to spend my life. I want to be creating and building and doing deep work and spending time with loved ones. And so sometimes it's just a recognition of, okay, this is not, you know, I'm not turning into a pedophile, but I'm just, you know, it's not me living my best life. And that can also show up in the way that we use YouTube and Instagram and dating apps and all these different things we can get addicted to. So realizing that, you know, it's a broader issue, really.
That you bang on right. And you know, as a dad, I'm thinking, you know, I've got a nearly 7-year-old daughter, and watching her and her addiction with already with watching and getting onto a mobile phone at 7 years old, and it really does bring up a lot for me about what is this going to breed, you know, how is this going to manifest as she gets older as well. And because yes, it's that you know, everything is about creating this dopamine hit that you've just talked about and alluded to. So that kind of opens a massive can of worms in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, and also coming back to, you know, young children, it's like, and this kind of brings it full circle to what we were talking about earlier, but just the potential for young kids to get their brains so messed up at an early age with the kind of stuff and stimulation that they're getting access to. I mean, a lot of times these addictive things that we're talking about are called hyperstimulants. You know, they're so hyperstimulating in ways that our body hasn't known about for 50,000 years. You know, we were never used to hyper-stimulating sugary drinks that, you know, are just sitting there pressing on the dopamine button. You know, we used to have to go eat an orange, or, you know, we would run after something and we would see, like, you know, to see a new woman, you'd have to like travel for miles to go to the next camp, the next tribe. And now we're just constantly bombarded with these hyper-stimulating substances. And we're pushing on the dopamine nonstop with TikTok, with Instagram, with social media, with junk food and porn. I mean, again, like young kids having access to aggressive, violent, you know, rape, BDSM, and they're thinking that that is what healthy sexuality is, which is such a scary thought. And I don't want to, you know, there is some healthy porn out there. There are some that, you know, from a women's point of view, are really focused on intimacy. But the majority of what's on there is violent, aggressive. There's choking, there's slapping, there's name calling. There was this beautiful TED talk recently I watched, you know, this person, it was from a woman, and she talked about how in porn, you know, women are constantly called like sluts and whores. And the way that the woman in a porn scene takes that is either neutral, where they don't respond at all, or they're like, yeah, call me a slut, call me a whore, I love it. And that is not how women want to be treated. Maybe there's some women out there, and there are some women who, you know, enjoy that, but to think that this is what healthy intimacy is, healthy sexuality, it's such a scary thought to know where we're headed.
Yeah, I'm with you completely. I just want to double check on something you said. I don't think you meant it, but you said, you know, you mentioned BDSM and then you said it wasn't healthy sexuality. And there are plenty of sexual practices out there. And, you know, this people of all genders are into. And I'm guessing that consent is the key piece. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that I know you didn't mean to say that, but just to kind of just to check in, like that's there's such an avenue of sexual exploration that we can go down. But the healthy version of it is with consent and exploration and healthy communication, right? And what you're saying porn is doing is just kind of normalizing extreme behaviors that especially are kind of really damaging to how men look and treat and respect women. Is that fair?
Totally. Yeah, and I wouldn't say that there's any, I mean, aside from the really egregious cases like child pornography, whatever, you know, people are all have their own kinks. And I think kinks are beautiful. You know, the things that turn each person on is it's great to explore. I think what's scary is just the overwhelming push to one side of the spectrum, where if 95% of what people see online is, you know, violent towards women, aggressive towards women, slapping, choking, you know, that's what people who are watching and growing up with it think is expected of them and normal. Rather than saying, hey, this is one option that you might be into and some people like it, it's becoming not just normalized, but that is what is like anal sex. You know, again, on porn, it's everywhere. You know, I don't even know, maybe 50%, whatever it is. But it's just the kind of the skewed view that we have of what you should be expected to perform in the bedroom. Again, for 7, 8, 9-year-old girls watching this, they're looking and they have no idea. They're like, oh, this is what mommy and daddy do. This is what I should be doing with my boyfriend when I turn 14 and have a boyfriend in high school. And so it's not to shame any kind of sexuality or say that any kind of kink is bad. I think it's beautiful. And so thanks for calling me out on that and really clarifying that. Because I don't want to give the impression that we're saying some types of sexuality are bad, but to really understand how we're being influenced by these things, because porn is an industry that is created to hook our attention.
Beautiful. Yeah, I didn't want you to be misrepresented in any way, because I know that's not what you meant. So yeah, thank you for articulating it even more beautifully. Just trying to wrap things up, unless Malcolm's got a burning question. Like, I know that you'd mentioned people are welcome to reach out to you. Like, I understand that you also have a more significant offer coming up soon in terms of some kind of group program. And I'd love for you to be able to share that here right now, if you'd like to.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. So coming up, I'll be offering, you know, a lot of the work I do is one-on-one, but for a lot of number of reasons, that's not available to everyone. So I'm going to be opening a group coaching program for people. It's, you know, a way to get some of the same information, the same wisdom, the same feedback and accountability, but in that group coaching context. So that should be coming in middle of August or so. So if you're interested, definitely just start following my stuff on social media or get in touch and say, I'm interested. It's called Unhooked. You're going to get access to my online course, which goes through all these different things you need to learn around envisioning, mental training, habit science, deeper fulfillment, how to actually connect with that and cultivate that. So yeah, definitely get in touch and just let me know if you're interested in that.
Beautiful. Thank you. Mal, do you have any burning questions? Are you still present? You've been either deep in thought or you've had another power cut.
Yeah, I'm here. It has flickered actually, but now that you, the thought that just came up for me is, as somebody who's been through AA and NA and the power of being in groups for this, so I just wanted to, you know, if anybody is listening and they're not sure, I could really recommend the power of being in a group around a support network for this kind of thing. It's incredible. And hearing you speak today, Jeremy, is really, you know, it's been a real pleasure. And you've spoken about a really, really difficult, challenging, hidden topic with such grace, and I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge, but also your experience today, mate. It's been it's been gold. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure to come on here, and I really appreciate the work you guys are doing with, you know, really just the question of what does it mean to be a man, and what does healthy masculinity look like in these challenging times where there's a lot of, you know, a lot of negativity in the online space. It's hard to talk about, you know, it's hard to talk about porn addiction. It's also very hard to talk about masculinity and what it means to be a man, because it's such a triggering topic for a lot of people. And it's a lot of divisiveness. And so I commend you guys for having the courage to talk about these issues with a lot of skill and nuance. So I really appreciate that.
You can come back, Jeremy. Thanks, mate. I really appreciate those words. Rich?
Yeah, likewise, brother. Welcome back anytime. Pleasure meeting you, and I'll be in Amsterdam in a month or so. So I'd love to hook up for a coffee.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Cool, brother. Yeah. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. And Mal, was there something?
I was just going to say I'd love to be over in Amsterdam to have a coffee as well, but I won't. So
you're in Bali, mate. You can fuck off.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I might be in Bali in November and December. So if you're still there, then we'll hook up for a coffee.
Now we're talking. Yes. Yeah. All right, you're on.
All right, everyone. Thanks for staying with us to the end. Have a beautiful day, Jeremy. Thank you once again. Ciao for now.
Ciao.
From this week's podcast, if there's been anything that's inspired you, challenged you, or simply left you wanting more, then please reach out to Richie and Mal via their Facebook page, Man Reimagined. Just like you, we're trying to get a handle on all these issues and topics, so the more we're able to share and talk about them, I think the better off we're all going to be. Until next time, catch you later.